Okay, our next stop in the Crime in the City series takes us to Dublin, Ireland. That city is the backdrop for the crime novels of an author who calls himself Benjamin Black. We say calls himself because it is the pen name of the Irish writer John Banville. Mr. Banville has won numerous awards for his novels, and this morning he takes us on a tour of his city. He went through that city with a microphone, and as he went, he spoke of his main character, a quirky detective named Quirk.
Quirk is a bachelor. He's, I guess, in his early 40s. He's a pathologist, a consultant pathologist in Dublin Hospital, so he's quite well off. He has a very dark and troubled past. He was an orphan. When he looks back to his earliest years, he sees only a blank, which is, I think, what drives him, what drives his curiosity, his itch to know about other people's lives, other people's secrets. He lives in Upper Mount Street in my old apartment. Well, we're in Upper Mount Street now, at Georgian Street, one of the few left in Dublin, but one of the loveliest. I mean, there's a marvellous prospect here. Very few people live here now. It's almost all offices. Looking back now, it's an entirely different city to the one that you see now. I mean, it looked the same, but it was an entirely different place. This is 39 and 40. It's this one. That was 39. And that was my flat. That was Ian Yates' flat. Doesn't seem to change very much, but I suppose I love this place. I feel very odd saying it. I mean, it's in a way, it's the cheapest thing you can do. It's like saying, you know, I love my mother, or apple pie is nice. But I suppose I love this place in a strange, embittered kind of way, which is the best way to love somewhere, I think. We've crossed over to the Grand Canal. It sounds as if it should be in Venice, but it's a very narrow little waterway, but rather lovely, I think, quite beautiful. Quirk walks up and down here. He likes to spend Sunday mornings coming along to sit on a bench here and read the papers. And somehow, in the way of crime fiction, all kinds of people meet him there, chance on him, you know.
Quirk sensed Sarah's approach before he looked up and saw her, walking toward him along the towpath. She was wearing a burgundy-coloured coat and a Robin Hood hat with a feather, and was carrying her purse clutched in both hands against her breast. She kept her eyes downcast as she walked, on the watch for puddles from last night's rain, but also because she was not ready to meet Quirk's surprised stare.
If you're going to write crime fiction, if you're going to write noir fiction, Dublin in the 50s is absolutely perfect. All that poverty, all those secrets, all that fog, all that cigarette smoke, all those drink fumes, perfect noir territory. The Ireland of the 1950s was a controlled state. The country was entirely in the grip of the church. The church here was the exact equivalent of Eastern Europe's Communist Party. We had an iron ideology that controlled every aspect of our lives, from birth to death. Now, everybody knew about child abuse. Everybody knew about these appalling orphanages, these terrible convents, these atrocious so-called industrial schools where children were sent to be tormented and raped. I mean, everybody knew. I laugh because one can't allow oneself to get angry, because one would be permanently in a state of rage. I'd like to be able to claim to have had a great social program in writing these books. I haven't. I'm a novelist and therefore a cannibal. I eat whatever comes near me. Everything is material. You know, child abuse, all those horrors, that's material, I'm afraid.
But you see, it's unnatural, this thing, Mr. Quirk, the nun said. That's the point. When bad folk take it on themselves to do what are supposed to be good works, it makes a sulphurous smell. I think you've had a whiff of it, that smell. Tell me about the child, Quirk said. Tell me about Christine Falls. No, I've told you too much already, he thought, just like Dolly Moran did. Please, things have happened, wicked things.
In these books, nothing is ever resolved. You know, the baddies are not put away. Poor old Quirk is as dumb as the rest of us, you know. If you wanted the exact opposite of Sherlock Holmes, Quirk would be your man. He just stumbles along, as we all do. close it all. We've come to a pub just around the corner from the Irish government buildings. It's called Donaghy and Nesbitt's, famous Dublin pub. Been here forever, I think. It's probably been here since the Vikings. Certainly looks as if it has. It's an old brown pub, entirely kippered by cigarette smoke from the good old days when you could smoke in pubs. Much frequented by parliamentarians and by lawyers. Lots of secrets are exchanged here. Lots of conspiracies are hatched.
Davy the barman brought their drinks. It was strange, Quirk reflected, that he never got to like the taste of whiskey, or of any alcohol for that matter. Even in the wild times after Delia had died, the sour burn of the stuff had always repelled him a little, though he had still managed to pour it into himself by the jugful.
Quirk's pub in the books is an amalgam of three or four pubs. A little world. A lot of alcoholism. I mean, serious alcoholism. People wrecked by drink. People of talent who drank their talent away. Who went home and hit their wives, beat their children. It was grim, but a lot of good work got done. People managed to write wonderful poetry, managed to write wonderful novels. I've said this too many times, and I've said it very stupidly, that I hate my books. I should add the writer that they're better than everybody else's. They're just not good enough for me. It's the constant search for perfection, the perfect sentence. That's what drives me.
That's the Irish crime writer John Banville, who was recorded in Dublin by NPR's Philip Reeves. The readings were from the novel Christine Falls, which he wrote under the pen name Benjamin Black. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Asia's Tibetan Plateau is the world's highest place. It is four times the size of France and home to most of the world's tallest mountains. And it may be that its deep chill played a role in the evolution of some of the world's most charismatic animals. NPR's Christopher Joyce has a story about a woolly rhino found on the roof of the world.
The woolly rhino, 2 tons, 2 tusks, lots of hair, and lots of attitude, was an Ice Age giant. It hung with woolly mammoths and giant sloths and other Ice Age behemoths in Europe and Asia, starting about 2.5 million years ago. But Xiaoming Wang was shocked when he found a 3.5 million-year-old rhino skull on the Tibetan plateau.
It caught us by complete surprise that they are actually up in the high plateau well before the Ice Age has started.
About 1 million years before the Ice Age started, in fact. Wang, with the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, thinks his discovery shows that at least some animals were prepared for the Ice Age.
At least in the case of woolly rhino, it actually adapted itself in the cold environment in the Tibetan Plateau before the Ice Age has even started.
Those adaptations included hairiness, of course, and a big body, which actually does well in cold weather. As you increase the volume of a body, say what's inside the skin, the body's surface area doesn't increase as much. Less surface area per volume means you can retain heat better. And then that second 3-foot-long horn on the woolly rhino, it was wide and flat.
The animal actually used it to sweep snow.
Why sweep snow?
So that they can get at the vegetation below the snow cover.
Wang says he has Tibetan fossils of an ancient blue sheep, technically a goat, but never mind, that eventually became another citizen of the Ice Age. So Wang thinks the plateau was a sort of evolutionary cradle for cold weather animals. When the rest of the world eventually iced up, they moved out of Tibet and took over. Anthony Barnosky is a paleontologist at the University of California at Berkeley, and he says even now these isolated cradles are important for evolution.
The interesting thing is on Earth today, we have biodiversity isolated in certain spots, and you just never know which of those isolated places is going to be the cradle of evolution for the next big environmental change coming down the pike.
The only problem is, to be ready, you have to know what the next environment will be like, or just be very lucky. The research appears in the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You might have heard probiotic bacteria help keep your gut healthy, but could they be good for your brain, too? A study out this week suggests the answer is yes, at least for mice, because mice on a probiotic diet for a couple of weeks were more relaxed than their counterparts who were not. They showed fewer visible signs of anxiety, lower levels of stress hormones, even chemical changes in the brain. Sounds a little like Valium, doesn't it? Other than signals telling you when you're hungry or full, what connection is there between the intestinal tract and the brain? And why would it be there? And all you yogurt lovers out there are probably wondering, is there any chance this finding might hold true for humans? Well, we'll talk about it. If you'd like to, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Go to our website and talk over there, or you go to our Facebook page, /SciFry. My next guest is an author of that probiotic study, published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. John Cryan is a professor at University College Cork in Ireland, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Cryan.
Thank you very much, Ira. It's good to be on.
This sounds amazing. You fed the lab animals probiotics, and why would they have any effect on the brain?
Well, I mean, it's been long known that the brain and the gut communicate, as you mentioned, in terms of feelings of hunger, etc. And so what's becoming clearer over the last while is that this brain-gut communication, or gut-brain, is a bidirectional communication, but also that the microbiota within, which is the gut flora within the gut, can actually also play an important part in regulating this axis. And so we can now describe what we call the microbiome gut-brain axis. And this is coming across in a whole variety of studies in a whole different ways. What we were interested in was just to test, we're just starting to see whether, if we fed the animals this lactobacillus, whether there would be any changes in behavior, in stress, and then what was driving this in terms of whether it was some of the targets that were known to be implicated in these behaviors. And indeed, we found it. So we went after this looking a little bit to see mechanistically how this could happen, which I think is what your question is. And what we found was that one of the major nerves, the cranial nerve 10, the vagus nerve, which is really very much a relay for monitoring what's going on in all aspects of visceral function to the brain. When this was cut, this nerve, these effects didn't happen. So we know it's happening through a direct mechanism on the vagus nerve, and there is a means for this communication. On the same way, when we've known for a long time that if you're feeling sick or you get a bad bacteria, like in a food poisoning, the same nerve will signal to the brain to allow you to express the sickness behavior. So it's kind of like the good side of that of what we've already known.
I've heard physiologists tell me that there are so many nerves in your gut, it's almost like a mini brain center down there.
And it's often referred to that as a small brain. And the enteric system is very important for maintaining all aspects of homeostasis.
Mm-hmm. And so people are going to want to say, of course, and I'm sure you've been asked, should I go out and eat a lot of yogurt with bacteria in it, will it have the same effect?
So what I want to impress on the listeners today is, from this study, is that it's just early days. This is the effects of one specific bacteria, one specific lactobacillus strain. And we're learning a lot about how these bacteria affect health and physiology, but we also know there's lots of differences between the different strains. And so this one isn't one that is currently commercially available in your supermarket, so it's different, although it's not you know, it's not unrelated to some of the ones that are there, but it is, we haven't tested this one in any human population yet. So I'd be a bit cautious in over-extrapolating from this to humans as yet. However, what I think the study shows and what I think is really important and why I think it's gaining so much attention is that it gives us the idea that the concept of treating stress-related disorders by modulating gut microflora can happen, and this can happen in a positive way. So it's encouraging, is what I would say.
You know, we've always heard about food also being very quieting to people. You know, when they're upset, I guess it might work through the same mechanism.
Well, I mean, definitely the vagus plays a role in satiety signaling and other aspects. And indeed, we're interested in our lab here in Cork, we're interested in the interaction between stress and food intake, although it's quite a complex interaction as well.
Why did the bacteria calm the brain down instead of make it more excited?
Okay, well, so what it did was it affected the neuro. What we looked at, it was a neurotransmitter, GABA, and GABA is the main calming inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. And what we found was that bacteria was able to affect the receptors, which are the proteins in the brain that signal the chemicals. So it affected the levels of these receptors. Now, we haven't, there's lots of other receptors and other neurotransmitters, and we haven't looked at this, but we plan to. But it is one of these things that we were quite surprised at, that we were able to get such a pronounced effect, and similar effects as if the animals had been given some pharmaceutical agents that are used to treat anxiety and depression.
So you see, you're saying that the effect was so strong that it was like taking a Valium.
The effects on behavior were very similar to what we would see if we'd given these mice an acute injection of Valium. Yeah.
Wow, that is pretty strong.
It really is, and we were really surprised about the robustness. And what was really neat about this is that we carried out these experiments in two different labs. So in my lab and my colleagues in Cork, and also that of the Bean and Stock and Forsyth labs in McMaster in Canada. So we were able to reproduce it in two different sites, which really gave us extra confidence that what we're seeing is real.
Do you think that different strains of different bacteria might have different effects?
Absolutely. And we know that from studies in immunology and on gut function and other aspects of physiology, that there are different, going to be different responses. Because the key here that we need to really find out is, what is it specific about this bacteria that's causing it to activate the vagus? Is it something that it's releasing? Does it need to be alive to do it? You know, there's lots of studies that we need to figure out. Is there an additive effect independent of the vagus? There's other things that we need to figure out. But what's important to reinforce is that, you know, if it is a metabolite or something that it is secreting, then that might be specific to that bacteria compared to another bacteria.
Mm-hmm. We have a tweet coming in from Jason who says, "What dosage did you use? I'm sure people want to try this themselves."
Oh, well, they won't be able to. I mean, one has to also remember that the what we give to animals is quite different because of their overall physiological differences. So we used doses, chronic dosing over a number of weeks, I think it was like 109 colony forming units of the bacteria was I think what it was. All the details are of the specifics are in the paper, but it's consistent with doses that other people have given to laboratory animals previously. But it's very difficult to correlate the doses we would give to animals up to what humans would get.
Mm-hmm. And so where do you go from here?
Well, we really want to find out how this happens. That's really one of the things that we want to know. We want to know, is it, as you asked, is it specific to this bacteria? And you know, would other bacteria do the same thing? And is it only lactobacillus? And it's probably not. Other good bacteria like bifidobacteria probably also do similar effects. But it's going to vary from strain to strain and see how it goes. And then finally, of course, we would like to try some type of bacterial intervention and assess, is it a true probiotic in humans?
Yeah, and so you will be doing human testing?
Yeah, I mean, our center in Cork is the Elementary Pharmabiotics Center. It's very translational, so we do everything from molecule all the way up to human intervention. So this study here would buoy us very much into attempting to try and do this in humans. And there has been some studies in humans with probiotics, although very limited. There was one out of France in the British Journal of Nutrition a few months ago, which was quite encouraging, which had a mixture of two potential probiotics together, which showed that they could affect stress and it could affect mood in a positive sense.
Boy, the drug companies don't want to hear this.
Drug companies? I don't know, but maybe the food companies do.
That's right.
You know, I mean, what's really neat about this and what's important to reinforce as well is that the mechanism that we're showing in terms of what it's doing to the brain chemistry is the same as what the pharmaceuticals are doing. So it's not undermining the actual biological theories underlying anxiety or depression in any sense. It's just showing that we can modulate them by maintaining good digestive health.
And that's the key, you're saying. Good digestive health.
Yeah. Yeah,
and if you do that, the bacteria will take care of themselves.
Well, it's hard to know in terms of cause and effect. We do know that, and studies from our own group have shown that if subjects have early life stress, and also studies from the U.S. has also shown that stress can affect the makeup of your microbiota, gut flora, and the composition of it. And we know that perhaps one of the things that the probiotics are doing in certain situations is kind of working to kind of rebalance any disturbed microbiota composition. However, evidence for that is still not clear, and these studies are ongoing. People are working on trying to basically look for signatures in various patient populations of the gut flora and see how it changes over time and over certain manipulations.
Mm-hmm. Do you expect an influx of money now from the probiotics people to keep
this
going?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, as you may know, Ireland is in a tough state for financially, so getting any type of funding for research will be very much welcome. We're hoping that this is a very much a conceptual change in people's mind with this paper in terms mm-hmm. of trying to move the idea that you can, by modulating the gut, we can actually have effect behaviors that are previously thought to be largely to be manipulated by agents that get across the blood-brain barrier into the brain.
Right.
So I think it opens up, and there's a lot of work to do on it, and I'm very excited about it in terms of the potential it might have, and especially in terms of the way it might impact patient care down the way, because some people are more eager to take a food agent than they will be a pharmaceutical.
All right, Dr. Crian, thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
John Crian, Professor of Anatomy, University of College, Cork in Ireland. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
It's easy to find drama in the life of Serge Gainsbourg. He was a wildly popular French musician and a wild man who burned money on TV and showed up drunk on stage. Our critic Kenneth Turan says the new film Gainsbourg, A Heroic Life, uses unconventional methods to tell an unconventional story.
Serge Gainsbourg is best known in this country for Je t'aime, moi non plus, the racy duet he recorded with British actress Jane Birkin. Gainsbourg is celebrated in France for the songs he wrote and the affairs he had with beautiful women like Brigitte Bardot. He's also known for being a provocateur who created outrage and scandal wherever he went. Gainsbourg is introduced in 1941 as a precocious 13-year-old, so defiantly Jewish, he insists on being first in line to get the yellow star Jews were mandated to wear in occupied Paris.
Je suis juif.
On the way home, Gainsbourg walks by an anti-Semitic poster. In the film's boldest stroke, the bloated caricature on the wall comes to life and starts to follow him home. That caricature morphs into an alter ego with an enormous nose who stays with Gainsbourg for the entire film, appealing to all his worst instincts. Writer-director Joan Svar, who is an acclaimed French comic book artist, won a César for Gainsbourg. To him, the songwriter's life is heroic because he lived in his own imagination and went toe-to-toe with those personal demons. Gainsbourg never had any difficulty getting beautiful women to pay attention to him. He had a complex cocktail of personality traits and could be simultaneously arrogant and insecure, shy and domineering. Gainsbourg's music continued to be adventurous and controversial, and never more so than when he collaborated with Jamaican stars Sly and Robbie to do a killer reggae version of French national anthem, La Marseillaise. It caused a riot when he debuted it in France. Gainsbourg, a heroic life, doesn't flinch when its subject goes deeper and deeper into alcoholism and bad behavior. Filmmaker Svar wants to give us a report from within the mind of this gifted, tortured individual. And this he brilliantly does.
Black trombone. Kenneth Turan, or Kent Vaughn, reviews movies for Morning Edition in the Los Angeles Times. This is NPR News.
And we'll hear about jobs and the economy now from our political observers, David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Good to see you both.
Good to see you.
E.J., the White House now projects growth this year to be under 2%, 9% unemployment next year. Have we reached a point where this is an acknowledgement of failure or defeat in trying to deal with the recession?
I don't know about defeat yet, but if anyone doubted that we wasted the last 8 months with our deficit obsession, and if anyone doubted that the president needs to go very big next week in his jobs program, these numbers should solve it. Zero job growth. Now, that is not a headline President Obama wanted 14 months before the election. But more important, one American in six is either unemployed or underemployed. That's not a headline they wanted to see. I was really struck in today's jobs report. They noted that government employment continues to go down. Local government employment alone has lost 550,000 jobs since September of 2008. That's a lot of people who can't buy goods and services. So the stimulus actually made that better. You didn't lose as many. The stimulus is now running out, and we just didn't do enough of it, and we got to do more.
But David, John Itzty left us with the question, will the Congress be able to pass anything that President Obama proposes? The long answer?
I don't have a long answer. I have a short answer, which is no. they have two fundamentally different views of what's causing the problem. The Republicans just think the stimulus didn't work, and I doubt they're going to be very enthusiastic about anything more. One thing we've seen, though, from this month after month of this bad jobs numbers is this is not a quarter-to-quarter thing. This is a long-term problem. We've had an economy with too much consumption, too little production, too much debt, too much financial manipulation, too much reliance on housing stock. And so we should have a If the president's going to go big, he should go long-term and have a plan that addresses some of the long-term issues and not worry quarter-to-quarter.
But you're talking about different narratives of unemployment. You wrote today in your column about Rick Perry that his aim is to make government inconsequential in people's lives. That's his word, inconsequential, to pare back the state to revive personal responsibility and initiative. Is that, in effect, saying private sector unemployment is the problem, public sector unemployment is part of the solution, as far as he's concerned?
As far as he's concerned. His narrative, which may take him to the White House, by the way, is that over the last several decades, and maybe going back to 1900, government has grown. It's taken resources out of the wealth-creating parts of the economy into the non-wealth-creating parts of the economy. I think there's some truth to that. But if you're going to rebuild human capital, if you're going to create a production-oriented economy, if you're going to repair the social fabric, You need to do more than get government out of the way. So I think his narrative is very partial, but it is a strong narrative which may help him politically.
I think it's a very weak narrative. The notion that spending on education doesn't grow the economy and isn't productive, helping people go to college, helping people retire so they can buy goods and services, helping people have health care, these are productive investments. And guess what? I think most Americans think they are consequential, not inconsequential. There is a radical individualism that Rick Perry is selling that I think is very different from traditional American individualism, which accepts that we want our personal freedoms, but we accept that there are things we do in common better or well, or we have to do them in common. And so I think if Rick Perry wins the nomination, we are in for one of the great philosophical debates since 1964 when Barry Goldwater ran.
I would just say that if this long stagnation widens the range of the political possible, People are going to be upset with tinkering. You could go left with big spending or go right as Rick Perry.
I agree, by the way, if the unemployment is really bad, even Rick Perry can get elected president of the United States.
David, what about the much narrower debate that would precede the grand one that EJ's talking about within the Republican primary field? What does Mitt Romney say about this? What's his answer to Rick Perry's narrative?
Well, right now it's a very bad answer, which is that he's been in government too long and you should go with a guy who was in the private sector. I think the smart, though very daring attack, as a colleague of EJ's, Bill Galston, wrote, is to defend Social Security, defend the New Deal. Rick Perry is really criticizing the entire New Deal. If Mitt Romney said, hey, I'm for scaling back government, but I'm not for scaling back Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, that would be popular. It would really take some guts because it would go straight into the teeth of the Tea Party method. But I think it would probably work politically because those programs are reasonably popular.
And especially in a Republican electorate, which is older than average, and that you went a lot of the interviews with Tea Party folks who are over 65, it turns out they rather like Social Security and Medicare, and you wonder why.
So here's the real question. If you had to give a televised address on jobs, would you rather go head-to-head with the GOP presidential debate or be the lead-in to the Packers-Saints game on Thursday night?
Ron Paul or Aaron Rodgers? I'd want to be tied to Aaron Rodgers, I think. So the viewership's going to be a lot bigger.
What do you make of this thing, this argument of when to have the speech on jobs?
Well, you know, if anyone thought it was really going to be easy to find bipartisanship, if they can't even agree on when the president goes to Congress, I thought it was appalling on so many levels. It was really appalling that the first president of the United States is turned down on such a request. And, you know, everybody's saying, well, there were reasons and this and that. That was outrageous. That's never happened before that Speaker Boehner did that. It does seem that there may have been some kind of lack of consultation by the White House, if they did spring this on Boehner in some way, that was probably a mistake. But now they backed off, and it's hurt them for backing off.
On the other hand, if the president saves the best part of his speech for last, he can catch a huge tune-in audience that's coming in for
precisely
that,
right,
that football game. EJ Dionne and David Brooks, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and we begin this hour with a retreat. President Obama has backed away from his administration's pledge to tighten health limits on the amount of ozone in the air. Ozone is the key component of smog. It causes asthma and other respiratory problems. Today, the White House announced that it would not revisit the Bush administration's health limits for ozone, even though they're based on outdated science. Industry groups say they are delighted with the decision because cleaning up the air to meet a new standard could cost $90 billion. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
The government is supposed to make sure air quality standards are adequate by reviewing them every 5 years. But when President Obama came into office, his administration said it wouldn't wait 5 years to review the ozone air pollution standard recently set by President Bush.
EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson said that the Bush standard was, quote, indefensible, unquote, from a scientific point of view.
Daniel Weiss from the left-leaning Center for American Progress had high hopes when the EPA proposed a much stricter standard earlier this year. Now, the standards themselves are supposed to be based purely on health science, not on economics. But the EPA also conducted an economic analysis and found that meeting the new standard would cost in the neighborhood of $90 billion. So industry pushed back. Howard Feldman is director of regulatory and scientific affairs at the American Petroleum Institute, which objected to updating the 2008 Bush standard.
So it would have put the entire country basically in a category called non-attainment, meaning not meeting the standards at all, which would impact how businesses expand to create new jobs and would have impacted existing businesses requiring additional controls on businesses in the U.S. where foreign competitors don't have that.
Feldman says it's not just industry who would lose if they had to spend more money on pollution control.
When unemployment is so large right now, now's not the right time to be putting additional rules that will threaten jobs.
That argument appears to have won the day. The EPA found that the costs of controlling ozone are more than compensated for by the economic benefits of lower doctor bills and greater worker productivity. But even so, the White House announced today that it's dropping the issue for now. Instead, it will wait for the law's 5-year clock to tick down to zero before taking up these contentious ozone standards. Of course, this isn't just a story about a struggle between industrial versus environmental interests. Janice Nolan from the American Lung Association says ozone is in our air right now.
Ozone can not only trigger things like coughing and wheezing and asthma attacks, can send people to the hospital and the emergency room because they can't breathe, but it also can kill people.
Recent studies show that even healthy adults can feel health effects from ozone levels that are below the current health standard, Nolan says. That means air that now registers in the healthy zone isn't necessarily so.
But those people in those communities think they've got healthy air because nobody's telling them otherwise. And that's why we are unhappy and outraged by this, because it is not telling people the truth about what we know about public health.
The Obama administration's decision to defer this health review means this particular issue won't be considered again until after the next election. But the Republican-controlled House has its sights set on five other proposed EPA regulations, and they're planning to raise those issues after they return to the Capitol next week. Richard Harris, NPR News.